From KUAR News in Little Rock, this is a look at Arkansas news, politics, and more. Coming up,
the governor's meeting with Arkansas lawmakers to discuss the Supreme Court's same-sex marriage ruling.
An appeals court refuses to reconsider its ruling, tossing out the state's 12-week abortion ban.
After last month refusing, this week the State Board of Education approves changing the assessment test used by schools.
Representative Bruce Westerman gets his first major bill passed in Congress.
And after more than 5 years of construction, work is almost done for West Little Rock's Big Rock Interchange.
That's coming up on KUAR's Week in Review podcast. And thanks for listening. I'm Michael Heplin, joined in the studio by Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
Hey, Michael.
And Chris Hickey.
Hello.
It's been more than 2 weeks now since the U.S. Supreme Court issued its landmark ruling that said states must recognize and allow same-sex couples to get married. But in Arkansas, lawmakers are still determining how to interpret this, what their response should be, and exactly what the state needs to do. This week, Governor Hutchinson began meeting with lawmakers. There's been a bit of a rift between some Republican lawmakers who are opposed to same-sex marriage, some like Senator Jason Raypert, and haven't been happy with the governor's response to this. From the day the ruling came out, the governor has said the high court has spoken and Arkansas must respect that. And Senator Raypert, one of his emails that he had sent to colleagues that he said was never intended for mass publication came out and exposed his displeasure with the governor on this. Why don't we first hear the governor's comments on Monday? He was asked about the meetings that he is having with some lawmakers. Not a lot of specifics here, but here's what the governor said during a press conference.
I met with the House caucus this morning. The House Republican caucus this morning, and I met with the Black Legislative Caucus this morning. Next week, I think I'm going to be meeting with the Senate, continue with meeting some of the caucuses as well. And so those conversations continue. Had a lot of good exchange of ideas, concerns, trying to understand where everybody's coming from. So it's very beneficial, very profitable, helps shape our thinking in it. My previous statements stand, and I refer you back to my previous statements.
So, Sarah, tell me a little more about what we know of what these discussions are about.
So last week, members of the House and the Senate publicized statements that they were going to address the issue of same-sex marriage legislatively, looking for protections for county clerks that could be passed in state law, and possibly increasing religious protections through another RFRA-type law. Of course, we all probably remember this year's controversy over the RFRA that passed in the legislative session, where major corporations and national-level scrutiny shifted the tide of political changes here so that the state adopted a law that looked much like many of the laws around the country and the federal RFRA, which applies only to government action, meaning that private entities and businesses can't have extended rights to discriminate against people based on their sexuality, citing religious beliefs. So that fight has already been lost in the state for those who wanted those. So the lawmakers are, you know, saying that they wanted to find something to do, and the governor responded at the end of the week with his own statement saying that there isn't much in state law that can be done to protect county clerks, and that he thinks that the RFRA that was passed was sufficient. And in the end, he led the compromise on that RFRA. And I don't think that he wanted to revisit that question given the pressures that were put on the state during the session. So this week he did meet with lawmakers. He met with the House of Caucus members from the House of Representatives on Monday, and then he said he was going to meet with members of the Senate later in the week. And our reporter Jacob Kaufman here spoke with various members of the House, and it seemed that those efforts had petered out by midweek, that there was no clear path forward to address the same-sex marriage issue. Yeah. On the state level.
So at this point, as you said, Sarah, it seems that House Republicans in the Republican caucus, at least at this point, are backing down the House Majority Leader Ken Bragg. Said there are no specific or immediate plans to respond legislatively to this, but that they want to continue looking at options. And it's basically been conceded that county clerks must recognize same-sex marriage, must issue licenses. And in fact, we had on Wednesday, the Van Buren County Clerk, Pam Bradford, who had said the day before that she would not issue same-sex marriage licenses, had even been very public with this, even sent an email out to all her colleagues, other county clerks around the state, urging them to join in with this. But one day later, she on Wednesday said that she was changing her mind and would indeed be issuing licenses to same-sex couples. This came after speaking with an attorney connected with the Association of Arkansas Counties. So I guess at this point, it's really a consideration of churches and others. As you said, the state must recognize these marriages, but some who are opposed to it still wanting to have clearly defined ways that they can not endorse same-sex marriage.
Well, of course, religious institutions are not under any obligation to marry same-sex couples, and that's never been in question. I think that some lawmakers were hoping that a special session would be called, and while we don't know what conversations have happened in the last week, it's clear that if there were any viable legal avenue to address any aspect of the situation, it might have been brought up, and it doesn't seem that there is.
Well, this is likely to be a matter that will continue to reverberate, and likely, yes, the governor said he doesn't see a need for a special session on this matter, but there very likely could be legislation brought up the next time the legislature gets together. Well, Chris, this week we had the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals turn down a request by Arkansas's Attorney General Leslie Rutledge for a rehearing concerning the state's 12-week abortion ban. Earlier in the year, a three-judge panel of the court tossed out the law, which was one of the more extreme in the country. Leslie Rutledge had wanted the full court to come together to reconsider this, but in a two-sentence statement, the appeals court said no. You were at a press conference on Thursday where the attorney general was speaking on an unrelated matter, but she briefly commented about this. What's her next move?
Well, basically, the attorney general's office has about 90 days to decide whether or not they want to ask the U.S. Supreme Court to review that decision. Now, like I said, she hasn't decided yet, and we'll see what goes from there. Just to backtrack a little, give some background here. In 2013, the Arkansas legislature passed this 12-week abortion ban. It was sponsored primarily by State Senator Jason Raypert, and passed along partisan lines for the most part, with good majorities in both the House and Senate. It was vetoed by Governor Mike Beebe at the time. The legislature overrode the vetoes and went into law. It was challenged by a group of doctors who provide abortions, and went into the court of District Judge Susan Weber Wright, who initially invalidated the law, ruled it unconstitutional. The first litigator on the state side was, at the time, Democrat Attorney General Dustin McDaniel. Later, Leslie Rutledge was elected, and she carried the case. It was appealed to the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. They also ruled that it was unconstitutional. And like we said, she requested a rehearing from this three-judge panel, but they struck down the law as well. And in the meantime, the 8th U.S. Circuit has awarded thousands of dollars in attorney's fees to the plaintiffs in the case, which the state of Arkansas will have to pay. Many observers feel that the law will likely remain unconstitutional in the eyes of the court. But at the same time, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court has, you know, maybe four or five conservative justices who might be willing to hear the case. So we'll see how it goes from there.
And as there are other states that have been bringing up more and more limitations like this, it very likely is something that may eventually have to be decided by the nation's high court.
Yeah, and I believe there's also a 20-week abortion ban that has been held up by courts in other states and other district courts. So, and Arkansas is a similar law.
Well, let's hear what Ms. Rutledge had to say. Very brief comments here, somewhat off mic, but you can make out her comments.
That case is still ongoing, and we're determining whether or not the Supreme Court cert should be filed. So,
well, the Supreme Court has a 40-year precedent that establishes a point of viability at 24 weeks. So anything that creates a stricter limit than that is unconstitutional. The Supreme Court could decide to reconsider the abortion ruling, but it's upheld challenges up to this point, and they would have to decide to hear a case, I would think, specifically to revisit that very question.
This week, the Arkansas State Board of Education voted to change the assessment test used in schools to use, as the governor had originally requested, the ACT college exam and the ACT Aspire for younger students. And Sarah, you've been covering this matter for quite a while now. It was just a month ago that the state board basically rebuffed the governor and opted to stay with the PARC test, which is more closely aligned with Common Core educational standards that have become so controversial. But this week, the board changed its mind.
Well, Michael, there's been some controversy over the Common Core-tied PARC test since the spring, when there was a legislative effort to discontinue the state's contract with it. The state's contracted with PARC for the past year, and it's spent something in the ballpark of $9 million to implement the test, which is an online test. So a couple of districts, Little Rock among them, had the opportunity and chose to make waivers and use a paper version of the test. But by and large, it's been implemented in the state already. And some lawmakers don't like it. The governor, that bill did not pass. But what it did do is establish that the test had to be renewed every year by contract. So a part of that contract with PARC allowed for the governor to end it at any time if within 6 months of his term. And while the Common Core Task Force asked that the test be discontinued, the governor's task force, the State Board of Education resisted dropping PARC. Members of the Arkansas Department of Education and curriculum specialists from the states were actually involved in writing some of PARC. So one concern was that the PARC represented a sort of federal imposition into education in Arkansas, which is the truth of that, I guess, seems somewhat mixed. And the test, on the other hand, was aligned with the Common Core standards, which was supposed to allow the state to compare test results with other states so that there'd be a national standard for achievement along with a national set of standards for students in math and in English.
Well, last time the board turned it down, but this time when the board met, there were three new members to the board appointed by Governor Hutchinson.
So the governor was disappointed that the board chose to vote against the test, and since then he's had the opportunity to appoint three new members to the board. One is a former Walmart chief human resource officer, and as you know, the Walton Foundation has been involved in education in Arkansas. Is funding the Forward Arkansas plan for the state, and Therese Dean of Little Rock, who's part of the Family Council group, and then Brett Williamson from the El Dorado area. So these new board members have ties to politically aligned education foundations in the state that are apparently in support of the governor's approach to the testing question?
Well, this week I monitored the hearing by the Board of Education. This has normally been your beat, but I monitored this hearing, and it was an extremely interesting one in that the board members felt essentially backed into a corner, is the way some board members put it, felt that this decision was being rushed, but that they needed to have a test in place for this fall. One board member, Vicki Savers, said that she felt this decision was being rushed and just didn't like the way this whole decision was being made. And here's one of her comments during Thursday's hearing. She's a little bit off mic, but you can still make out what she's saying.
This is the first time in my 20-some-odd year experience in education seeing an assessment be created and developed in this manner, without a procurement process, without the ability for educators across the state to really weigh in and ask questions.
Saying there, yes, that it was the first time she had seen such an important matter rushed in this way. Others, board member Jay Barth, also expressed similar concerns. Both she and Barth opted to abstain from the vote, which ended up passing 4-2. They abstained because they just didn't feel comfortable with it. The three new board members supported the change. They also heard from Johnny Key, the governor's education commissioner, who argued that this change was in the best interest of the state.
We are firmly convinced that the ACT Aspire gives us the building blocks starting at grade 3, that as those students progress through the system and they get to that 9th and 10th grade, they're going to be exposed to what we as a state have adopted as our policy, which is the ACT being the score that helps us gauge students' readiness for college and careers.
But with this change, Sarah, this will be the third test in 3 years that schools will now have to change to. That's got to be tough for teachers in the classroom to constantly be changing what tests they're preparing students for.
Yeah, it wasn't clear, obviously, until yesterday if the ACT would be used, because last month the state board voted against switching to the ACT and said they wanted to continue with the PARC test. And then, of course, the governor sort of overruled that decision. And this is a part of a larger political trend in the South, where Republican states are pushing back against Common Core after several years of implementation. In Oklahoma, they discontinued the use of it. In Tennessee, they're reconsidering whether they're going to keep using Common Core. And in Arkansas, there hasn't been so much controversy, it seems, around Common Core itself, but the PARC test has taken a lot of this fervor about, you know, federal overreach. And it's actually like somewhat unclear what the real issue with PARC is. But the ACT, although it's not explicitly aligned with the Common Core standards, ideally will become aligned. That's what ACT specialists told state board members in last month's meeting. So this has been a very political process, and the governor has established a task force along with the lieutenant governor to make recommendations. And he's appointed recently the education commissioner. Now he's appointed members of the state board and has held community forums to get input. And of course, the decision about the testing was made actually before those forums were completed. And so the task force is now going to issue recommendations on Common Core this month. But it seems that the most political questions of relating to the test and the standards have been essentially resolved by the governor based on what his agenda was. And it's unclear to me what is really behind that push away from PARC.
And you mentioned the Common Core Review Task Force. So we're expecting a formal report from them likely by the end of the month.
That's what Lieutenant Governor Griffin said. It was originally said that it would be out by the beginning of the month, and now he said the end of the month. So we'll wait to hear what they have to say.
Chris, this week, Congressman Bruce Westerman of Arkansas's 4th District got a chance to present his first major bill in Congress. Tell me about it.
Yeah, the Resilient Federal Forest Act of 2015. Bruce Westerman was the lead sponsor on this, and it went through, you know, numerous committees, went up for a vote on the full House floor Thursday, passed mainly along partisan lines. A lot of Democrats voted against it. And basically what it would do, and the purpose behind it, is to kind of recalibrate forest management practices on federal lands around the country. Now, as I found out in reporting this, there's been a lot of issues with the U.S. Forestry Service being able to address sort of these forest conservation policies, thinning out forests so they're not as susceptible to wildfire, engaging in projects that would eliminate the potential for the spread of disease throughout the lands that the federal government owns. Supporters of this bill, including Westerman, say that a lot of these U.S. forestry projects that they say will help conservation programs are being stalled by lawsuits filed by environmental groups. And they call them frivolous lawsuits because oftentimes environmental groups will object to a certain project or policy. They'll seek a preliminary injunction in federal court, and the project is stalled. Meanwhile, the Forest Service has to use a lot of funds out of its budget to litigate these costs. So part of the bill, what it does is shift more of the Forest Service's resources towards conservation, fire management, and at the same time, it also prevents plaintiffs from seeking preliminary injunctions in federal court. It also requires the plaintiffs to post a bond on the legal expenses that the Forestry Service needs to use for litigating these lawsuits.
Well, in addition to talking with Westerman leading up to this vote, you also talked with the Sierra Club as well as the Forestry Commission. But what was the concern of environmentalists? Why were they opposed?
Well, they say by having to post a bond to cover the legal expenses of the Forestry Service in lawsuits like this, it's a prohibitive expense, and it will likely stymie a lot of valid lawsuits, in their view. At the same time, the fact that a preliminary injunction cannot be ordered by the court would allow objectionable Forestry Service projects to take place even if a lawsuit is finally decided in the plaintiff's favor or the environmental group's favor. Here's Glenn Hooks, director of the Arkansas Sierra Club, commenting on this.
If we think that they're not following the law, if we think that they're doing a burn that's outside of the published limits, if they're doing timber harvests that are illegal, then we can go in and if we can convince a judge that there's at least a chance that we are correct, then they will halt those operations until the facts can be found. That's a really important ability in the case like this. You know, if we didn't have the ability to get a temporary restraining order or a preliminary injunction, then they could just go in and do the damage. And then even if we found them, our allegations to be correct after the fact, the damage is already done. So these kind of tools are really important to protecting our national forests. This bill threatens to take those away.
And also on the House floor before the vote on Thursday, Democrat U.S. Representative Nikki Tsongas of Massachusetts, who actually praised a lot of aspects of the bill in shifting resources toward conservation efforts and forestry management policies out of its budget, also spoke in more blunt terms about what she thought was actually an unconstitutional provision of this bill.
If this legislation were to become law, a citizen challenging a federal decision would be required to post a bond equal to the government's costs, expenses, and attorney's fees. If plaintiffs lose, the government is paid out of that bond. But if plaintiffs win, and by win, I mean a court has to rule in favor of plaintiffs on all causes of action, plaintiffs simply have their bond returned and are precluded from getting an award of attorney's fees. As our colleagues on the Judiciary Committee can attest, this provision flies directly in the face of American legal precedent.
There was an effort on the House floor to insert an amendment to do away with the having to post a bond on the legal expenses of the Forestry Service. But this bill passed, and it'll go to the Senate next. Westerman, in light of this, is kind of being... he's kind of casting himself as an environmentalist in a way. He appeared on C-SPAN the day after the vote on a morning talk show talking about a range of environmental issues, including this forestry bill. And actually, I should qualify this. When asked if he was an environmentalist, he said he preferred the term stewardship and conservationist as kind of a subtle... way of distinguishing himself from maybe more left-oriented folks.
There's ways to manage the forest to make it healthy, and healthy forests are good for everything. No matter what you think about global warming and carbon, trees are the answer for that. Through the cycle of photosynthesis, they take in carbon dioxide, release oxygen, they store the carbon in the trees. When we cut a tree down and build a house with it, that carbon is stored in the house. A new tree grows back in its place and it pulls more carbon out of the atmosphere. We've got more forest cover in this land, in this country now than we had in 1900. A lot of people don't realize that. Trees are the answer.
An irony I noted in this bill is that a lot of the critics of it say it takes away from the private citizen's right to hold their government accountable, and it basically gives an unchecked authority to the federal government. Now, Bruce Westerman, as we've known in his time in the Arkansas legislature, has been kind of a small government conservative. He opposed the expansion of Medicaid in the state and so forth. But his bill really... allows the Forestry Service to go about its projects in a way that's not as obstructed as before. Although it doesn't necessarily increase funding for the Forestry Service, it does give them more authority, and it lends the federal government more authority.
Any indication what kind of support this will have as it now moves to the Senate?
It's unclear. When I spoke to Westerman, he said that he had been in conversations with Senate folks, but of course it'll have to go through numerous committees and probably numerous hearings.
Okay, well, we'll see. Well, this week we had one big story probably for people who travel in West Little Rock. After more than 5 years of work, a $150 million project to completely redesign what's called the Big Rock Interchange is nearly complete. This is where Interstates 430 and 630 meet. This interchange was built in the late 1970s at a time when you didn't have the extensive development that you do have now in West Little Rock. As officials noted, it was completed before there was a Financial Center Parkway, before there was Chenal Parkway, when that road was essentially a dirt road that connected that area with Highway 10. But since then, that's been the where we've seen the biggest growth in Little Rock. And on Wednesday, we had a ceremony at the top of the tallest ramp, one that goes from I-630 westbound to I-430 southbound, to officially do a ribbon cutting, even though work will continue for a couple more weeks. But it's expected that ramp will open to traffic this weekend. I spoke with Scott Bennett, the director of the Arkansas Highway and Transportation Department, after the ceremony. Here's what he had to say.
There's still a little bit of work that has to be done where this ramp, which is the westbound to southbound ramp, ties back into Interstate 430. Of course, we need to stripe the ramps. A little bit of just what you would call really punchless items to be able to have traffic be able to move up onto this flyover and flow smoothly back onto Interstate 430. So we're closer than we've ever been. Hopefully just a few days away, but not much more than a week or so away at the most, when we'll have everything open up to traffic. And the contractors will still be here for a couple of weeks to take down signs, do a little bit of dress-up work and things like that. So you will still see orange barrels and a few orange signs for a few weeks, but we are very, very close to total completion on this project.
So you mean we'll have two lanes
right
on all the ramps?
That's right. We'll have two lanes on all the ramps, and of course you'll have to merge in at some point, but right, all the ramps will be two lanes and things will flow much more smoothly now.
How big has this project been? How long in the works and what's gone into this?
Well, planning started for this project in 2004, and that was when really this interchange was about 30 years old, and that's about 10 years beyond the useful life of a highway project. So we started planning in 2004 and actually came up with this concept in 2006, and then started the design process, started the public involvement process, got everyone involved, explained everything to them. By that time, we started to really piecemeal the funding, so we had to phase some of the improvements. And now, 2015, $150 million later, here we are with what we think is what's going to be a signature project for years to come.
Tell me a little about the growth out here and, you know, what this area was like when this interchange first opened and what necessitated this.
Well, that's right. This interchange, the way it was, worked well for many, many years. When these two interstates were completed in the late 1970s, you had 14,000 vehicles a day on Interstate 430. You had 21,000 vehicles a day on Interstate 630. Now you have a total of 200,000 vehicles a day on average that drive through this interchange. There wasn't a lot west of here, so most of the traffic was just between 430 and 630. It did work well for a long time, but now with the completion of Financial Center Parkway and Chenal Parkway and the growth out west, there's a lot more traffic movement out west. It created the need for the overpass of Shackelford and the need for these more direct ramps.
Finally, this project, federal funding, the highway bill was key to it. Tell me the situation in Washington right now and your concerns about what that's doing for highways in Arkansas.
Well, you know, really, as a highway director, sometimes I have to be manic depressive. This is a really great day to cut a ribbon on this project, but at the same time, we've had to pull over $300 million worth of projects from our lettings this year because of the status of the Federal Highway Trust Fund. We don't know if we're going to have a federal highway bill after the end of this month. We don't know where the money is going to come from. The money is not coming in the way it used to come in to have the level of a federal highway program that we've had in the past that we've really enjoyed in the past. And federal highway funds make up about 70% of the construction funds for our highway program in Arkansas. And those are funds that are generated in Arkansas that go to Washington and come back for these highway improvements. So it's a very, very large and important part of our construction program. And we need that to continue so we can continue to make improvements like these around the state.
Okay. Have you been in touch with the congressional delegation?
With all of them, they are all very well aware of what the issues are. And I think the sentiment across the nation is the same. Everyone knows the importance of a federal highway improvement program. No one can decide for sure how to pay for it. We pay for it historically through motor fuel taxes, and motor fuel taxes just don't generate the revenue that they have in the past, and they don't keep up with inflation.
And with that, we are done. You've been listening to KUAR's Weekend Review podcast. I'm Michael Hiplin.
I'm Chris Hickey.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
If you aren't a subscriber to this podcast, we hope you'll go to iTunes and subscribe. We'll be here every week bringing you a look back at news, politics, and more, the big stories we cover throughout the week here at KUAR News. KUAR is an editorially independent service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. Our theme music is composed by Chris Hickey. Thanks for listening.